Right. Well, thanks very much for inviting me here. It's a great pleasure to be in Santa Barbara. I'm going to talk about quantum feedback networks, which was some work I initiated with Matt James in about 2006. I'll also talk a little bit about coherent control, which is the ultimate aim of quantum feedback networks. We came up with the title quantum feedback networks because it didn't seem to exist anywhere else when we Googled it at the time. There's quantum networks, quantum circuits, and a lot of other things. But this seemed to suit what we were trying to do. To a large extent, our backgrounds are sort of very similar, but maybe a little bit distant from theoretical physics. I'm a mathematical physicist. Matt James is an engineer. And we're both coming from quantum control from this side. Typically, this interested in very mathematical systems, usually described in continuous time rather than discrete time. So quantum information is really not our main goal here. It's really dealing with dynamical systems, controlling dynamical systems and dynamical models. And the whole purpose of quantum feedback networks was, how do you build things up from first principles? If you have various components and you know how they work, what happens when you start sticking them together? How do you stick them together to make them work in some particularly desirable way? Okay, so I'll just list some of the papers that were instrumental to this. There's one in communication and mathematical physics where we gave a Hamiltonian treatment of the networks. Most of the time we're going to work in the Heisenberg picture, but to actually do the theorems you have to work in a sort of scattering picture where you have to look at the Hamiltonian. I might say a little bit more about that. This is the most general result. There's a result known as the series product, which is a special case just for cascading systems, which appeared in IEEE transactions. Automatic control. And some other people picked up our work from the mathematical point of view related to fractional linear transformations, which I might have a bit of time to say something about later. So the basic goal here is to do quantum engineering. Most of you are familiar with the paper of Dowling and Milburn early at the start of this millennium, which sort of set out some concrete ideas on where we should be going towards a quantum technology and why we would be looking to harness quantum effects. Now for networks, well, the philosophy is really, you know, since the early days when we had transistors, how do you put transistors together to form an integrated network? The obvious benefits to this. And as you all know, with the current trends in miniaturization, Moore's law is predicting we're going to get down to atomic systems before too long, maybe in the next 5-6 years. So we're very much interested in putting systems together. So effectively, the philosophy is that control theory, to a certain extent, is really how do you connect systems, or given one system, how do you connect it to another system, nominally a controller, to improve the behavior, to meet some performance criterion that you set. I'll just say quickly, in the quantum world, you have to distinguish two types of controls here. Well, actually three types. There's open loop, but I'm not interested in open loop. I'm interested in feedback. There's coherent feedback control, which is something you describe fully quantum. So the system you're trying to control is described quantum mechanically, as is the controller. There is, however, measurement-based feedback where you're making measurements on the first system, and based on what you read out, you're then trying to come up with an optimal control to actuate the system back. Trivial distinction classically, but when it comes to the quantum mechanical case, the whole question of measurements rises up. They are very, very different. So Again, the idea, classically, what is control? It's really having one system which you want to stabilize or you want to enhance performance somehow, and you have a second dynamical system which you couple it to in order to achieve that. But it's essential that information, in some very broad sense, is being conveyed from the system to the controller, and the controller then acts back on the system to achieve whatever goal you want to do. So this is usually set against some specific control objective. So if there's nobody looking from outside and it's all just working autonomously, you can refer to that as as coherent feedback. Measurement feedback would mean that at some stage you have an engine or some system that's working. You're making measurements on it, and of course it's a great problem where exactly you put in the divide between the quantum system and the classical observer. And the classical observer then, based on the measurements, the information obtained, acts on the system accordingly. Now, I have to say, I riled Klaus Molnar when we had a conference in Denmark a few years ago.
Where did he want to go?
Philosophy is, yeah. Controlling system is really about connecting them up. And when you're an engineer, and I guess mathematical physicist, you sort of think of systems as little black boxes with known dynamics, and it's a question, how do you connect these boxes up? So I just, someone spotted it, it's Lego. So really, engineers like to think of systems as little boxes, and you can then do analysis on the boxes, you can do synthesis where you're putting the boxes together, and the question is, knowing how the boxes fit together, how do you then use that fact to build something useful, right? Now, early on, Seth Lloyd, and this I think around about 2000, introduced the term coherent feedback. Now, this is a little bit different from what we mean. So I'll just describe this briefly. The idea is you'd have some system here which you want to control. And what Seth basically considered was just having a second system which is directly coupled to the first system. So really it's now a bipartite system of your system or plant and some ancilla, your controller. So the question is really, how do you get the two to interact, right? It's what is the potential here? It's a non-local evolution now between the two systems once you introduce some coupling between them. So Seth's question was really, given your system dynamics, what benefit does it do to couple it to some governor? But it has to be a proper interaction between the two. That's not, in principle, what we mean. We actually mean that the information going between the two systems is typically carried by quantum fields rather than just by direct coupling. Now, I'm going to have to give you a quick run through quantum stochastic calculus, which is the framework we use to describe quantum fields. Simplest thing is just to think of a piece of string, right? This isn't quantum string, this isn't string theory, it's just a string, and you place a harmonic oscillator at each point of the string, quantizing it, right? So you have a piece of string, that's basically your world. You can look at wave functions on the string. That's first quantization. Then you can have an indefinite number of indistinguishable particles on the string. You've second quantized the string, okay? And that we'll create them as bosons. So maybe take the string to be the whole real line. The idea is you have creation annihilation operators, white noise operators, if you like, satisfying a singular form of the canonical commutation relations. We label things by T and S on the string, so this you can think of as arc length. A little later, we'll be thinking of signals propagating along the string, so think of a transmission line. And we can think of the signals propagating at, say, the speed of light. So rather than talking about space as being the parameter, we can think of it as time, right? Time to propagate. So if you were here, if your system's at the origin, how long does it take your signal to come in at the speed of light? So we'll often interpret the t here as time. Now, these are singular, but you can consider more regular operators B and B dagger, written as capitals. And these you can work with rigorously. These are operators of second quantization, which are well defined on the Fock space, which underpins this Bose field. These were introduced by Hudson and Pasterati in 1984 as a non-commutative version of Brownian motion. In fact, if you add these two together and take the vacuum state, you've got a representation of the Wiener process, the ordinary Brownian motion. And in fact, they developed the whole Ito calculus around this. And generalizing the usual property of the Brownian motion that the square of the differential is equal to dt, which basically signifies that the sample paths are typically of unbounded variation. You know, the square of the increments is not negligible, but order dt. What you have is the product of the annihilator with the creator in this particular order gives you a dt term. In fact, probably the simplest way of thinking about this is just going back to here. And the calculus, the Ito calculus, really works in normal ordering. And it's the effects of putting things to normal order using the canonical commutation relations that gives you corrective terms. And the corrective term is summarized by expressions like this. So think of this as a result of normal ordering of the white noises, if you like.
What do you mean by dB?
I mean,
so formally, I mean
the differential.
dB is just little b ds, and dB dagger is little b dagger ds.
Yeah. Almost, but not quite.
Okay.
So first of all, we always mean future pointing differentials. So implicitly understood that dt is in the future here, the differentials always go from now to some point in the near future. And I guess if I had some other process, well, where do I put it? I'd put it here. And we can then define the integral of this. But I have to put the x here, because of the normal ordering rule. If I wanted to define the same thing with dB dagger, I could put the dB dagger here, but I'd have to basically put the x on the other side. It's just a little bit of care with normal ordering.
If you normal order the thing on the left-hand side algebraically, you say a commutator will appear, that's how you get what's on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
It's not an average. You mean
no, it's not. It's normal ordering.
Normal order. We use this tensor product symbol here. Here we're putting together a fixed system. The noise is going to live in the Fock space. So what we could do is try and consider a unitary stochastic process which couples the system to the noise. So the noise is a field. The unitary system is just something quantum mechanical. There are two forms of these equations. So this is a quantum stochastic differential equation for the operator U. We can write down something that formally looks skew here in skew Hermitian in the brackets here. provided we interpret this as vial ordering, we have to do some normal ordering to get it into some useful form. And roughly speaking, this corresponds to what's known in stochastic calculus, ordinary stochastic calculus, as the Stratonovich form, which is basically defined by something like this. This includes a second order correction, which may be non-zero. The process of going from the vial ordered form, where you literally just have it, this should be related to the Hamiltonian term, but with, if you wanted to write this as just du, you'd have L times B dagger minus L dagger B, which is skew Hermitian, minus some Hamiltonian term. Putting things to normal order, you pick up a correction, which is a damping term. Okay, the process itself is actually unitary. It's also adapted in the sense that it only entangles your system with the component of the noise up to time t and not beyond. So we might have some initial condition starting from time zero where u is the identity. From this,
no question.
Yeah.
Is that just one of many possible interactions with the field, or is there something special about that?
No, this is the simplest form. I mean, we could have several fields, right, and several L operators. We can also consider scattering, which is a more general problem, which I'll get onto. Now, this is just, again, just thinking of it as a transmission line carrying in quanta in. This is basically telling you in the interval t to t plus dt in the future, you're creating a quanta into the field while applying an operator L to your system. This is the joule, right? You're destroying over the time t to t plus dt, and this is what happens to the system. And this is just your background Hamiltonian for the system.
If I would act on these operators on states, and try to implement the same picture on wave functions, is that?
Oh, yeah, 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 no problem.
Does this then correspond to the ordinary Monte Carlo wave function?
You're talking about quantum trajectories, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you can derive, I mean, there's no measurement yet, but you can derive all of this.
In terms of L, if there is a measurement.
Yeah. I'm not discussing measurement, but I'm happy to talk about how you do quantum filtering after that. That's measurement-based feedback. You have to then locate something like a quadrature of the field to measure or the number of quanta, and then you have to go into the output picture because it's not the input fields you're measuring what's coming out, right? But yes, you can derive all of your stochastic master equations that way. That's the late Slava Belavkin's work. Okay, so what we might do is just to say, well, given a system observable, how does it evolve in the Heisenberg picture here? So this is involving entanglement with the, or interaction with the field as time goes on. And from the quantum stochastic calculus, what we actually get is, again, this is a Nieto differential for how the observable is changing in time in this picture. There's a drift term, so a dt term. The operator here, the super operator L, is just then your typical Lindbladian, right? Plus you've got two fluctuating terms. Again, because of the choice of Eto differentials here, the B dagger and dB live in the future part of the Fock space and actually commute with everything that's in the past and with the system. And if you averaged it in the vacuum state, they'd actually disappear. These would average to zero, just leaving you with the following differential equation, which you can then go to the density matrix picture to get the master equation if you want, right? So a typical example of this is where we choose your coupling operator A to be just, say, L, sorry, to be the annihilator for mode of your system, which you take to be a harmonic oscillator. So what happens is, this is just photoemissive. If you create a quanta and put it into the field, you apply the operator L, which is just moving you down a mode. And of course, the converse is that if you absorb a quanta, that's dB. You've got the adjunct of this with a minus sign, that's creating. So that's basically leads to the usual description of an optical system, and you get the optical master equation out of this. Add more noise in if you want different fields, right?
And John, sorry, I have a little problem, yeah, which comes from comparing the clock with the fraction of transpices that you have up there.
Yeah.
And
don't worry,
I want to be fair to everybody, so I'm not sure what to do.
Right. We're about 5 minutes late.
No, we're late. No, sure. But I thought that 23 transpices in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit tight.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay.
We'll do what we have to do. I just mentioned that you can also introduce a scattering process, which basically tells you about quanta being created and at the same time, annihilated and then created at the same time. And then you look at this over some interval naught t, and you actually enlarge your set of non-vanishing products of differentials to include this table. And you have a neither product rule, a quantum version of this, a non-commutative version of this. This actually dates back to 1984, which is 1 year before Gardner and Collette came along and had their theory of input-output processes. For any pair of adapted processes, adapted just means based on the noise up to a particular time t at each time t, you don't have the usual product rule, but you have this correction here coming from effectively normal ordering, right? Again, when you want to describe averages, you need to put things to normal order because that's where the fluctuating parts drop out and you get what you want. But you get the dissipative corrections largely coming from the non-vanishing, the t parts of this normal ordering here, so the Zeto correction. Okay, what you need to know is what's the general form of a unitary evolution entangling your system with the field in this manner, so this causal manner. It'll look something like this. We have the Hamiltonian as before. We have the operator L describing the coupling to, in this case, the emission of a quantum into the field. We also have a scattering term. An important thing to note is that S has to be unitary. L can be arbitrary. This coefficient is not just minus L dagger, it also includes the scattering bit. And H has to be Hermitian. That is, has to be a self-adjoint operator. So if you're looking at the Heisenberg picture for this, you still pick up the same Lindblad generator involving H and L. S doesn't enter into it.
What is E11 and E?
Oh, that was what I was motivating here and which I'm rushing through. Just if you wanted to go from something vial ordered to normal ordered. Okay, so the prologue. Right, this triple of S, L, and H consisting of a unitary operator S, a coupling operator L, and a Hamiltonian H, we think of this as the block, right? These are the blocks we're going to stick together. The fields are carried on through the input, passing through to give you an output. So if this triple, S, L, and H, which gives us the data which describes the system itself and how it's coupling to the field, okay? So when we think of the black box, we basically think of this triple S, L, and H. You can compare it with Gardner's input-output formalism. This is lifted from his book. You consider the system at the origin, and you've got an input field and an output field. We're basically generalizing this, first of all, to have a non-trivial scattering term. Again, you can isolate the input and output fields. So just to repeat what we had earlier, this is what the Schrodinger picture looks like. That's an Itô quantum stochastic differential. Despite the damping term here, this is actually unitary, right? This is the general form of your Heisenberg equations of motion for system variable. Again, you notice the Lindblad term here. If I took X to be the identity, this vanishes, all the commutators vanish, as you'd expect. So it means it's conservative. Now, I didn't tell you what the output fields were. I told you what the inputs were. The outputs are basically obtained by taking the inputs and, again, multiplying by U dagger and U either side. And resorting to the Itô calculus, you can work out the differential for the output field. It involves a unitary rotation. Remember, S is unitary of the inputs. We're in the Heisenberg picture here. Plus a drift term, and that's the coupling operator L, again in the Heisenberg picture. So the output should be contained some information of the coupling of the input. This is very much related to the boundary condition in the Gardner-Collett model. He usually takes S equals 1. He doesn't bother with the gauge process. So effectively, something of the system should be coming out with the output, right, if there's been a genuine interaction. And to answer your question about if we were doing Hamiltoning, we'd be looking at the quadrature associated to that, and that's what we'd be measuring in continuous time. Or we'd be looking at the conjugation here of the gauge process, lambda, giving us the number of quanta to be measured. I've looked at the CISO case, single input, single output, but it's very easily generalized to multiple inputs and outputs. You just need a vector of operators describing couplings of each field and an n by n matrix. Again, these can be operator valued. This has to be unitary, right? Telling you how the various inputs relate to the outputs. Okay, I just mentioned with regards to the scattering, that includes a simple example like a beam splitter. Okay? Now, this is a picture which ought to be familiar to control engineers, the idea of a plant, that's the system you want to control, connected to a controller. The difficulty if you're doing information being passed by quantum fields, transmission lines, is that things like splitting up a field and sending one part this way and all of it this way, you can't do, there's no cloning. So these have to be replaced by unitary gates, or beam splitters. Essentially some black box which takes, at least in this case, two signals and gives you two signals as input and two as output. Okay, so the first non-trivial network you could consider are two systems cascaded together. This actually goes back to Carmichael, later done by Gardner, input-output systems. So the question is, you have the SL and H for this, you have the SL and H for this, you're feeding the output of this in as the input for this. Assuming zero time to propagate, this is then one Markovian system. What are the overall SL and H parameters for the two? Well, you can sort of guess what the, from just looking at what the output is, it's the product of the unitaries in this order. It's the coupling operator of the second plus this unitary rotation of the first. With Mark, we worked out the complete triple, because you also have to know what the Hamiltonian is, and that's what we call the series product. Interestingly, you don't have to assume that the two systems are actually different systems. You can take them to be the same system, in which case it's information coming in and then going around for a second pass, a double pass through.
Instantaneous, I mean, that more or less basically that there is no memory between the two systems?
To some extent, yeah. But I mean, if you want to work within
kilometers away, then you are in trouble.
This is a standard approximation in classical engineering, so yeah, we do have to worry about it, but I mean, in terms of coming up with a, the idea is to come up at least with a single Markovian model for the combined system. And there's really no other way, I think, to describe it. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult. So just an example of a double pass, there's a paper of Schirsch and Moller where they look at ways of enhancing squeezing of light by passing light beam through the system twice. Some people use the beta RAR series product to derive exactly the same results. If you're clever, you could consider a double pass through a system where you have the same coupling going through each time, but due to a mirror here, it sort of cancels out. You pulse in some classical field here. So again, you can think of this as applying some displacement operator. Ultimately, you find that there's no scattering, so it's just the identity, no coupling, and you get a Hamiltonian term, which is just a bilinear term. So this is the way, in principle, of at least generating any bilinear Hamiltonian. So L is the usual coupling, U is some complex function which you want to use so that you can shape yourself by pumping in. Yeah, that's the result of Howard Wiseman, which we were able to put into the form of our network theory. I'll just say, he has a model of detection, but you don't actually see the result of the detection, so you can treat it all coherently. It's non-selective. Okay, that's all fine looking at the series product, which is all essentially feed forward. We needed to come up with some way of looking at models, for instance, of the following form introduced by Masahiro Yanagisawa, where things are now not topologically simple anymore, right? The signal effectively goes through a beam splitter and can go multiple times around before coming out. And again, you can do some playing around with this to work out what the S and L parameters are. More generally, you'd want to consider now having several components, and if you put them together and assume instantaneous feedback, what's the overall network going to be? Maybe just a quick word on non-Markovian. You could let the coefficients here depend on time, and in fact, you couldn't let them depend on past history of the fields as well. So it's not as Markovian restricted as it might seem at first sight. There are two operations you need to build up a general network. First of all, you need to know if you had several components, how do you just put them in parallel? This is what we call the concatenation. It's just doing the obvious thing with the SL and H parameters. You form a unitary block matrix along the diagonal. You have the S's. You put the L's together to form a column vector and just add the Hamiltonians. More tricky is how do you actually eliminate an internal edge? This took quite a bit of work, and I'm happy to talk about it, but haven't got time to go through it here. If we do want to have an output being fed back in as an input, and then we eliminate that, right, in the model, we've got a model reduction. The reduced SL and H triple takes this form here. This is, first time here is actually a short complement of the original unitary matrix, and as long as this is invertible, this ends up being unitary. In fact, there's some nice results on fractional linear transformations, non-commutative versions due to Siegel. This is Carl Siegel, which shows that this unitarity is preserved. And again, you can sort of see, if you compare this with what goes on in linear systems in engineering, if you expanded this geometric series out, right? Well, this is the direct term. Expand this out as a geometric series, you see, well, this is where you come in along one edge, You then go in the internal edge, you go around n times, and then you pass through one last time, and then you just sum over all n to get this. So it's rather nice like that. It's somewhat surprising that it does come out in this fractional linear form, but that's due to the fact that the linearity is in the fields. The actual system itself is nonlinear. So Hendra Norden is going to talk a little bit about the more general structures related to this triple here, and a different type of elimination, which is adiabatic elimination. And I guess it's going to be assembling the SL and H into the following matrix, but I may as well show you this here now. So this will be in Hendra's talk. How am I doing? I'll probably just finish with this. I showed you the classical picture earlier, and I told you for passing information from a system to a controller, you just can't clone the information, right? So in principle, you think of your system here, in general allowing crosstalk between inputs here and outputs here. The X here could be a controller. You could even make this an open system as well. This is a simple cartoon in principle of how you connect up a system to a controller. Again, it's quantum system, quantum controller, fully unitary model, so it's a coherent feedback model. Unlike Seth Lloyd's picture, where you just have direct contact between the two, it's actually now being mediated by quantum field, the laser beam, for instance. Actually, the purpose of this was actually to describe for us any system, you pass it through some gain here for the internal part, and the gain in general could be some other unitary object here. This would reduce to a fractional linear transformation as a function of this X here. The fractional linear element will be taken up by Hendra. Okay, so I better wind up. I had a few more things to tell you, but that's probably close enough. Applications I'm happy to talk about later.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Could you say something about how you would include this finite propagation time, if you're interested in that kind of thing?
Yes. It's very difficult to do it in the general case. If you're looking at systems which are basically linear themselves, right? So an assembly of harmonic oscillators, then you have the whole Fourier analysis at your disposal. And there, putting in time lags is not terribly difficult, right? It's just putting in the appropriate phase between transfer functions. But to do it in a more general case for nonlinear, yeah, because I haven't assumed that anything on SL and H other than the structural requirements, that's much more difficult to model. Because you have to remember, if the field takes a finite time to propagate around here, the noise coming back is in the past. And then you have the trouble with the Itô differentials, because they're now shifted back into the past, and that could cause a lot of problems. You don't actually have the full use of the Itô calculus now.
So you really have to start.
Yeah, you have a lot of work to do. My feeling is that it's probably something like path integral methods which would crack this one. Quantum stochastic methods looks very, very difficult.
Mr. Jake had a question?
Yeah, I was kind of curious about the extension beyond photonic fields. So the linearity part you actually answered already for me, so thanks. Which is, I was curious to what extent everything depended upon the system itself being linear, and the answer is not at all.
No.
But I'm also kind of curious about the extension beyond bosonic fields. So in two different possible ways. One is
Fermi's not a problem. Fermi should work pretty much automatically, because
I mean, it seems the only crucial requirement is this, that the coupling is bilinear. That's the coupling is bilinear.
In a sense, yeah.
So I think what I know. Challenging, for example, is if I had Bose field, and system all coupled in the same interaction, that would be a problem. But like.
Right, and these are singular fields, so if you wanted to consider, for instance, squares of the...
Then those would drop out of the calculus system.
You're in real mathematical problems there, right?
Yeah, okay. But you see, fermions in principle is also no problem. Except for the initial state.
You have to be careful with the coupling that... you have to couple Fermi noise to a Fermi system, and you have to get the parities right. So the SL and H are going to have strict fermionic parities. But if you do that, it actually comes out looking exactly as the Bose case.
For the vacuum.
Yeah.
But for fermions, typically it's not the vacuum that's our initial state. That's actually somehow the challenge, right?
For the field?
And for fermions, it typically a Fermi C.
Right, but there is probably some sort of what we call a Rackley-Woods construction, where you replace something like a thermal state by two copies of the vacuum field. So that ought to be, in principle, doable.
Ivan, can you say a few words about how you actually then solve these equations? I mean, you're not going to do it in the Heisenberg picture. You're going to...
But once we have the SL and H, we work in the Schrodinger picture.
And so are you solving correlation functions, or are you solving for the whole?
It depends on the problem. Usually what you're asking is for a fixed system here, and completely arbitrary controller, or say range of controllers. And from a controls perspective, as an engineer, you set out with some objective you want to do. You want to minimize, say, some observable being averaged over time here. You have some particular goal, and then the question is, how do you construct the controller? It's internal and external. You might have a question that you bring in some disturbance here. So you move this, you displace this. So there's some disturbance coming through. How do you minimize the disturbance effect on the output? And again, it's a question of how you associate, how do you come up with the appropriate...
There's going to be some, I would imagine you need to ultimately do some appropriate approximation, because you're going to have some correlation functions that are going to go to some infinite hierarchy, and maybe you assume some Gaussian type...
Not surprisingly, so far is when this is a linear system, and a bunch of oscillators, and so is your controller. And then you can dip into L infinity and H infinity, H2 and H infinity control techniques. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You could also just convert it to...
Andrew Norton is...
Stochastic algebra.
Right. Well, it depends what I'm solving for. I mean, am I solving the whole state of the whole... all of my system, or am I solving for some particular set of correlation functions? I don't know whether, or what circumstances that's doable. I mean, and is this formalism going to give me a handle to solve problems that I'm going to solve from some other traditional?
Well, the idea of the formalism is telling you how to connect systems together, which is the first step. Then it becomes either a design problem, how do you design the controller for a particular objective? And it's very much the engineering philosophy here. You're doing the problem to meet an objective, so you start off with the objective as the first point, right? I haven't talked about any engineering here, but this philosophy is fairly crucial.
A question related to not transition time, but loss. Can you put loss elements in the...
I've drawn this as if it's just one field, but really this could be multiple fields, right? This all vectorizes very simply. And the multiple fields could be just open noise, which you don't model or you don't intend to measure at any stage. Likewise, you could put noise in with the controller. With the controller.
But I mean, let's say I only have a single field, but I have a lossy element in the middle, meaning that not all of the...
Yeah, that just means having another field, right?
Stick a beam splitter in the
Josh, in the question?
Yeah. You already have here, sir? Oh, you should. You're before me anyway.
No, I'm thinking in the interest of time, well, I should, first of all, I should appreciate and thank especially John for accepting to give the first talk, and actually he came after we made the decision yesterday that we would have 30 minutes talk plus 10 minutes discussion, and we're having a fantastic discussion, but of course maybe he didn't prepare the talk just for to be squeezed in 20 minutes at least, so I thank him very much for helping us to keep to the schedule, but of course there are questions, but Joran already has his shot, so maybe I will give it to Josh.
So John, there was a little bit of talk yesterday about non-Markovian systems, and you brought it up again today. I'm just wondering if you think it's possible, or if anyone has proved some sort of Solvay-Kataev type theorem for SLH networks using general open quantum system evolution.
I mean, my understanding of Markovian, or at least my definition, is your SL and H are basically fixed operators on your system. There's nothing to stop you replacing these by operators satisfying the same structures to guarantee unitarity, but depending on the field itself up to that particular time. That's non-Markovian. Feedback reduction, I don't think anyone has looked at yet, but certainly the series product would be the obvious generalization of what I stuck down here.
So maybe I can be a little bit more specific. Do you think it's possible to model most non-Markovian evolutions using some generalization?
That I don't know. In principle, again, this is our philosophy, that if you want to get a particular type of noise, say, what you do is you take white noise, put it through a particular system, and that colors the noise, and then that's the output. So then you feed the output into whichever system you want to drive. Now, this is a very natural way of doing things, and engineers use this a lot, right? So it's completely artificial, you know, this ancillary system which just colors the noise. But again, it's just cascading. The question of what you can generate this way, that's another question entirely. It has come up, but it's not clear what, you know, people claim that there are non-Markovian systems you can't generalize, or you can't generate using just coloring, but if so, that's something we can't treat.
You have one already mentioned, which is the time delay.
Yeah.
That's a non-Markovian system right there.
So I would allow one last question. The reason why I'm doing this is that we keep the time because there is of course a lot of questions, and do this because so we have a lot of time in afternoons to come back to John to talk, to have more discussions and so on. So it feels a little uncomfortable, but we made yesterday a decision together to try to keep to that. So one last question, please.
Have you been thinking about extending this in also in space dimension? I mean, sometimes it's important to think about spatial coherence. You know, if you see nice clocks, for instance, which is a hot topic, one would perhaps be interested in what happens actually in both space and time.
Yes, but you want the fields to depend on both space and time.
They do.
Okay, but
if you have a satellite and you would like to communicate with one protocol or whatever, right?
I mean, the idea of thinking of things as just signals propagating in one direction along a line, right, is that if you're in a fixed point, which you can take to be your system position, you know what's passed through. And you know that it's what's passed through over a certain time period which has coupled to your system in the past. You have this causality built in. Now, if you've got different fields coming from different directions, from different positions at different times, how you can try and manageably deal with that, I don't know.
Okay, so, sorry, I come from Germany, and as a monitor, we are going to have Hendra now, who was present at our discussion yesterday, so he's very aware of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcel. Thanks for the organizer.
I think there should be some sort of reason. Okay, interesting.
Okay.
that's a round of applause to John, I think, is very much.